Congratulations. You're listening to Congratulations Pine Tree, the Bay's number one arts and culture podcast with me, Kate Rhodes, and my co-host, Maysoon Waswas. But this week, we're both under an avalanche of work. Maysoon's training for American Idol, and I am finishing installing my show over there at Royal Nonsuch Gallery, 300 Jefferson Street, opening Saturday, May 12th from 7 to 10. Okay, but there's a ton of openings happening on Saturday, including a show at Et Al, etc., curated by Margaret Tedesco. Selections from the Kurt McDowell Estate. You gotta go to this, okay? It's going to be up from May 12th to June 23rd, and the reception is Saturday, tomorrow, 6 to 9. Also, Lauren McKeon is having an opening at Land and Sea back over in Oakland, so go to that as well. Also, at the Growlery, opening on May 19th from 7 to 10 p.m., friend of the show, Layla Weaver, has a show coming up, Noise and Thirst. And that is going to be up from May 19th to June 8th. Also, Lindsay Tunkel is releasing a new book next week called When You Die, You Will Not Be Scared to Die. Wow. Through Parallax Press. Lindsay Tunkel is a conceptual artist who's been looking at themes around fear of death, human existentialism, and the end of life on Earth. This sounds like something I need to read immediately. Also, Matt Katsaros has Fielding Connections over at Irving Street Projects. That will have a closing reception on May 20th from 11 to 2 p.m. Okay, so since Maysoon and I are basically dead this week, we wanted to share with you an episode from one of the art practical podcasts, Unmaking, hosted by Weston Teruya. And before we get to this excellent interview, I just wanted to let you know that Art Practical, you know Art Practical people, it's a listener-supported organization and reader-supported, and their goal is to raise $15,000 by June 1st. All funds from the campaign, their fundraiser campaign, will go directly to supporting Art Practical audio podcasts like Unmaking and What Are You Looking At, both excellent shows that you need to be listening to, as well as the rest of their writing, audio programming, book publishing, and events. And you can donate to them at artpractical.com/give. So please do that. I'll put a link in the underworld. Support Art Practical. They are so great. So here is a little taste of what they're doing over there.
Hello, welcome to Unmaking, a podcast from Art Practical. I'm your host, Weston Teruya. Each episode, we talk with artists, cultural workers, or arts administrators of color to discuss their work, how they got to where they are in their careers, and how they situate their practices in the world at large. In this second season of the podcast, we'll be looking at a specific theme, place, and how it impacts the work of artists and cultural organizers. Over the course of 10 episodes, we'll talk with our guests about how artists create work in response to specific sites, the local communities and resources that support, generate, and come together through culture, how artists and cultural workers engage with questions of belonging, and the stakes and process of asserting space and presence in relation to our neighborhoods and the land. In this episode, I'm very happy to talk with filmmaker, storyteller, and community archivist Vero Mojano. Vero's work delves into the cultural history of San Francisco's Mission District, creating spaces to assert and remember the queer and Latinx communities that shaped and continue to shape one of the city's most iconic but highly contested neighborhoods. In an area often seen as ground zero for the city's tech industry-fueled hyper-gentrification, real estate speculation, and displacement, Vero's work brings together people to remember together in public and for others to listen and learn from those memories. She's had a long presence in the neighborhood, producing events, films, providing social services for folks, and you can hear that history and presence in how she talks about her work and the people in the mission. In our discussion, we talk about Q-Sides, her collaborative exhibition with Carrie Orvik and DJ Brown Amy, 2-4 Homegirls, circa 1980, an exhibition of archival photos documenting the lives of Mission's tiny locas she helped curate with Claire Haggerty and Sandra Quadra, and the film event she produced at the DeYoung Museum, also with Sandy. Vero breaks down why nostalgia is such a critical tool for her community in this time of change,
her work as love letters to those who will hear them, and Queer Longing and Imaginary as a lifelong project. Before we talk with Vero, this season on Making the Rounds, a recurring segment where I recommend something I've been listening to, looking at, or I've generally found provocative of late, I'm going to try my best to highlight projects or conversations that also reflect on our season's theme of place. I recently made a trip down to Los Angeles, and while there, I visited Bowtie Project, an outdoor public art park created through a partnership between Clock Shop and California State Parks on a strip of land between the banks of the LA River and active train tracks. While I wasn't there for any of their large temporary public projects like Rafa Esparza's Con Safos or Carolina Caicedo's One Body of Water, I did encounter Rossin Wu's LA River Interpretive Signage Program, a set of informational kiosks that use the design language of park infographics, where you might expect to find trail maps or information about the features of the local ecosystem. In them, he talks about the social-political context for the park itself. One sign contrasts the popularization of camping as recreational leisure activity in the US on one hand, and the demonization of urban campsites created by those without housing on the other. An acknowledgement of the encampments at the edges of the surrounding industrial area and along the river's concrete embankments. The second sign near the park's entrance points to the interrelationship of ecological remediation, real estate speculation, and park development, making visible the tensions in the park itself by also mapping some of the recent commercial land transactions nearby. The kiosks are a little hard to read in places because they've been tagged up since their first installation, but are still accessible on permanent or semi-permanent view in the park. And with that, here's our conversation with Vero. Can you talk about the role cultural memory plays in your work?
Been thinking about that. I guess a lot of my work has a lot to do with that, and I feel that for me it's the materials that I have to work with. Lack of a better word is like nostalgic, you know, like I work with stuff from back in the day, and I think it's someone who's born and raised in San Francisco and in the Mission District and being queer that I have a lot to collect with and make something with, at least with memory. I think what is unique about my experience here is that I am queer, that I grew up in San Francisco and in the Mission District. And, you know, like San Francisco is, growing up is where everybody came to, ran away to, right? We're the Mecca. And like, where do you go when you live in the Mecca? You know, where do you run to? Mm-hmm. And I think that I work with memory because it's the materials that's been given to me to work with. I don't think, like, I thought about it, like, I work with memory, you know. I think my work has been called that, you know. But I think from people naming it that I've been thinking about, oh, I work with, it's the materials that I'm working with. And I think memory is one of the materials that I work with. I've been doing collaging lately and just as a coming home after work. And I was thinking about that when I was making it. I'm like, oh, this is actually what I do with a lot of my work. I'm collecting and putting together and making an image or in a story. Like, so it's done change. San Francisco's done change, right? Like, I feel like we're lucky to be here and make art that we're living in the post of gentrification. Like, we're surviving, right? And, like, I feel that with my work that I'm interested in, that it's included in San Francisco history, the Mission, at least in an audience together, we archive it, the memory. Like if I'm doing a story about, as I do storytelling, I like the idea that at least collectively right now we are archiving this moment, this story, and that we experience it together, you know? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like, I think that what I'm trying to do, I guess. Like, and it's all happened like, I'm just now really looking back, like, what is my work? You know, what does it mean? And because I started making art at a later age, and I think, like, just right now, I just turned 51, and I'm like, I'm really comfortable calling myself an artist. You know, like, yeah, I am an artist. So, that's what I've been thinking about, yeah.
And so in that process of archiving things together and collecting those stories, is there something that you want that group of people that you're gathering together to get from that process? Like what gets generated from coming together like that, especially in this post-gentrification time, as you say?
I'm attracted to sticker tags, I guess you call them, taggers. And I just found this one, and I see this person around a lot.
And it says Rude Boy Edgar.
Yeah, and I see them because I started doing my own stickers, my own print stickers, and I've like been putting them around, and like I'm really attracted to the sticker tagging culture right now. I think it's really pretty, and it's all about I'm here, mm-hmm. I'm here, and you see me here. And they're young men, and I think that they would trip out that a 15-year-old dyke is following them around, and then I'm oh, that's Rolls Royce. That's, oh, yeah. Like, so right now, what I'm attracted to is that, you know, like, I could show you some of the stickers. And first, I'm attracted to that. And then I like to share what I'm, you know, turned on by, like, what's making me feel good. When I walk home from work, I've been serving the population that is experiencing homelessness for 20 years. So, when I walk home from work, I kind of just need to let go. And that's how I started getting attracted to the stickers, to the tagger stickers. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correct. So, and then me being attracted to that and like digging it, and hopefully someone else would dig it, what I make with it. So, and also connecting, like, I mean, there's so many different levels about making art. For me, when I'm performing, I really dig the connection part, you know, like when it happens, it's so good. I mean, it's pretty, like, it's the best drug that I, you know, and I'm too old to do drugs, so now I got to do perform and connect. So I think that for me, selfishly, when I perform, it's, I want to get that hit of connecting. You know, and that when you feel it, it's just so good. And so for me, that's the first thing. And I guess it's selfish. I want to see if I can connect. And then when I do storytelling, some people come and share like, oh, that reminds me of my experience, or that really made me laugh, or it reminds me of my cousin. Or so I like that part of connecting with my work. Yeah, like it's just pretty. It's pretty simple for me, like that, you know. Like,
And I'm curious because you were first talking about memory in relation to nostalgia, and in some ways, people talk about that as this thing that like is lost, but we're detached from now in some ways. But then you're also like through the storytelling and through your interest in sticker tags, it's also about like you were saying like this immediate. I'm here. This is my presence.
Yeah, I was here.
And,
I'm here.
So, like, there's that, like, this thing that's possibly locked away in the past, but this immediacy. And in the work you're doing, like, especially with the films that you're and archives that you're building, do you also see those as, like, this intervention? And, like, do you put it out to different communities that you think really need to see it who might not be part of that history?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've done that with a couple of my works. I co-curated the show at the De Young a couple years ago, and we showed a couple films from the archives that I work with, and then my own films. And what was wonderful about that event was that it was at the De Young Museum, and all the films were about the mission, you know, and they were people that came out there that had never been to the De Young, and they've been here, like, I'm talking like people who are in like their 50s or late 50s. They just never went to the De Young, so they came out to that. And Sandy Cuadra, we curated it with Sandy Cuadra, RIP, she passed away. And so we're showing these films that have some archival footage, and what was so beautiful about it was that there's people in the audience that's like, oh, there goes my uncle, there goes so-and-so, or someone who passed away. So it was like this moving photo album. And then there's the audience who maybe they were like first, you know, maybe new to the mission or sharing a space with the homies, right? And like, I think that that's a good experience where the, lack of a better word, the new residents of San Francisco get to see who was here, and then they get to witness that. So that's almost an installation. I really like that part of bringing audiences together. The same thing, and it happens organically. Mm-hmm. It happened with the Tani Loca show, the Mission Girls show that we did, co-curated this exhibit at the Mission Culture Center, I don't know, like maybe 5 years ago. And they wanted to show my films. And Sandy Cuadra, again, I said, no, I don't want to show my films. I want to show Sandy's photos. And Sandy, she was part of this group called Tani Locas. And for me, they were like the finest girls in the hood in the 80s. So I said, I want to curate her photos, because she just had them in like boxes. And she took them all with the 110. And 110 camera, Kodaks, and so we curated at the Mission Culture Center, and it was curated like if you go to someone's home and see someone's photos, and it was the same experience. You know, all the homies came out, they're like looking at the photos. Oh, there goes so and so, and then the new other folks who just haven't had that much history or been here in San Francisco that long, they got to experience that and share the same space, like people witnessing people reminiscing. You know, mm-hmm. like, and I feel like sometimes homies, all we got is nostalgic. You know, some people critique nostalgia, right? Like, and for me, it's just like, that's all you got. All you got is back in the day to remember sometimes. That's all you have. So I think that I'm kind of working with that a little bit. And I understand why nostalgic is critiqued, but I feel that at times it's also a privilege to critique nostalgic, and that's all you have. It's like, that's why you see that corner guy still listening to that song over and over from like the 80s. It takes your body back to maybe when a place was good, you know, and it reminds you when maybe you were doing a lot better. So I feel like I like working with nostalgia, is that, you know, even though I know that nostalgia means like, nostalgia means missing home. Like, I think, yeah, something like it was a condition at one time, like in some war, like way back in the day, like the young soldiers, like were missing home, and they were suffering actually from nostalgia because they were missing their mom's home cooking and stuff. So it was a condition at one time, you know. So, and I think that some of us that lose don't have a lot, and a lot of things are missing from our lives that we suffer from that, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's the romantic in me, too, so, yeah.
I do like the ways that you connect it to that physicality, that it's about that sense of loss and that people actually feel it, or, like, they hear music and something transforms in you, or, like, you're saying that it's about bringing these people together so folks can see people's reactions to that, and that's... That.
Yeah, and it happened organically. It's not like, this is going to happen. It's just, it ends up happening, and I never want to count on that, because then you miss out on the it happening like on a natural vibe, you know, like so I think. And also when the show we did with Carrie Orvick and DJ Brown Amy, we did Q-Sides, and that was the we replicated these or restage or reimagine, so many people use that language on it, like these lowrider LP albums that came out in the 80s, and there were, everybody had them, you know, but they were made out of vinyl. I mean, they were vinyl, and then like in front of, there was 12 of them, 12 volumes, and then like in each image, there's like a, you know, homeboy with his ride, with his homies, with his ladies. So we recreated every album cover with queer folks in it, and it was called Q-Sides. And the theory with that was that the idea with that was that it's the flip side of a B-side. And we had the opening at Galleria, and again, like, it was one of those experiences where, like, well, our goal was for that project to work with lowrider. We work with lowrider clubs to use their rides and stuff, and then the opening of that was like a part of the, it became part of the installation of the show, because then you had different folks coming in, like all kinds of queer brown kids dancing, and then, you know, all the homies dancing with their ladies, and like, there's some video of it, and like, every time I see that, I'm like, wow, we were hoping that would happen, and then it happened, you know? So I think that, I think that it's something that's becoming part of my work of bringing different audiences together, you know. So, and it's beautiful to witness, you know. Like, so everybody gets a hit off it, you know. So, yeah, that's what I'm. I don't know if that's what I'm aiming for, but I'm like that. That's the surprise. That's the lovely gift at the end, you know. Every time it's different, so I don't think I ever want to aim for it because then there's no room for the beauty to happen, you know. So,
well, it's funny because in some ways, I like the fact that you kind of embrace the fact that it's this natural thing that organically happens. But I also imagine that some of it is also just because you've been doing the work for so long and you have this presence with these different groups of people, you're able to pull that together. And so are there ever moments where you do need to kind of step in more actively to negotiate and say like, oh, you might have these questions about this, I'm going to facilitate you coming in or anything like that?
No. And I think also with Q-Sides was also the relationships that DJ Brown Amy has, right? And then Carrie Orvik, what she had. So that was a collaborative effort of bringing all those all those folks together. No, I don't think I've think about that, you know, because I'm so like wrapped up in trying to get the project done, you know, I'm just hoping people show up. So, you know what I mean? Like, so I think that I don't think about that. I think because, yeah, I'm from here and I'm in like different parts of the world, you know, there's like my homie, my queer homie, like, you know, the serving the community that I've served for. And I think that, like you said, I think that brings in a lot of people, but we have, you know, with the Q-Sides, there was a lot of beautiful things that happened with that, connecting with folks. And then there was also, you know, what happened to the Maricón Collective mural there.
Just a quick insert here. For those who aren't familiar with what happened with the Maricón Collective mural, Galería de la Raza has a street-level billboard on the Bryant side of their building at the intersection with 24th. They curate a series of temporary mural projects in that space. And in the summer of 2015, time to coincide with Pride and the Q-Sides exhibition, they commissioned a piece by Manuel Paul of Maricón Collective, the Los Angeles-based queer Latinx artist and DJ group. The image depicted two men holding one another, two women gazing intimately into one another's eyes, and a shirtless trans man with visible top surgery scars, all rendered in Trollo-style line work. The billboard was defaced several times, with attempts made to cross out and negate the images. The incidents escalated, and the Monday after Pride, someone attempted to light the mural on fire. Luckily, a neighbor living right next to the billboard was able to stop the fire from spreading and further putting people's lives at risk.
And we were also getting, like, on social media, like, all kinds of threads and...
For the show,
yeah. And from, like, you know, they aren't really homies because they're queer, there's no gay people in the hood, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, yeah, that's the point. This is why we did the show, right? And for me, what I got out of there is, like, okay, so... maybe you are not the audience, you know, I'm not talking to you. Like, and so I have been thinking about the audience, like, who am I talking to? Like, I'm not talking, like, Q-Sides, we were talking to the homies who grew up around this and who are not included in the homie culture, lack of a better word, homie, you know what I mean by that, though, and... because we would have people come in and after, you know, when the exhibit, when people come in and just like people coming in and like, I wish my mom was here to see this show. And this young girl said, because my mom, she had a girlfriend, but she couldn't do it. She, the pressure of the family, she couldn't be with her, you know, or young man saying like, walking in and hearing the oldies, because we had the oldies playing like 24 hours. It was just playing and listening like, oh, my father used to listen to this, but I never thought that this music was mine because my father had, you know, issues about me being queer. Mm-hmm. Like all these beautiful interactions like that. And then the flip side was this homophobia, right? Mm-hmm. And it made me think like, oh, but I wasn't talking to you anyway. Like I'm talking to... those interactions that came in, that's who I'm talking to. And just to be like, you know, you apply for grants, it's like, who's your audience? You got to go hella big, everybody included. And like, You know, like, I'm talking to who's, like, who hears my love letter. Mm. I'm talking who hears the song, you know, like, it's like a love letter of my work. I'm like, that's who I'm talking to. And if you can't, if you're not able to hear that, then I'm not talking to you, boo. Like, you know, like, you know, like, that's kind of what I've been thinking. Then I'm not really talking to you. It's okay. Like,
what I also think is beautiful is that there is that targeted focus, but then even what you were describing with the opening, like the fact that it was this mixture of like queer folks and lowrider folks and like audiences that from the outside people might not expect to come together, but you brought them together. And so it's, there are these intersections that are happening. And so people who are positioning themselves as like, we're in the neighborhood and we don't think this should exist are sort of casting this aspersion across a really broad range of folks who came together for the project.
Yeah, and I think you got, for us, we have to focus on the love, you know, like, it's just like, we had to, and it's like, because I swear they, like, some of those guys, they just sound they're Republican. It was just like, really, do you hear what you're saying? Like, for me, it's like, some of these guys are like my age, probably, that I grew up with. I'm like, man, you're 50 years old. If you don't think there's queers in San Francisco in the hood, I don't know where you've been. Like, so stop acting like this is something new. You've never been around it, you know? So, and I just didn't want to focus my energy on that. I mean, we were concerned about our safety. It didn't, like, break my heart, but it did be like, all right, you don't have my back, but I have your back kind of situation. Mm-hmm. Meaning, like, you know, a lot of queer folks do a lot of social work. We have your back. We're in those marches. We're just as pissed off. We're leading some of the marches when the homies get shot. I work with a lot of homies who are down and low at my job, you know? And it just made me think of, like, all right, I have your back. You don't have mine, you know, that realization all the way, you know. I mean, straight up homophobia. You know, people would try to say, like, oh, it's because, you know, gentrification and people, it's part of the culture, you know, they're losing their homes. And it's like, don't give the brown man a break because they're brown about homophobia. It is homophobia. And like,
And that erases your experience as someone who's been
here. So it's just like, oh, it's because they're brown. It's like, no, they're 50 years old. They've been here for a while. Like, so I feel that I don't have a lot of patience around that. So that experience made me think about, like, right, I'm not talking to you. It's okay, boo. Like, someone else will talk to you. Mm-hmm. You got a lot of people talking to you, billboards, everything, you know, so I'm not talking to you. So you can listen. You're welcome to be here. But, like, so I kind of think about it that way right now, you know.
Yeah.
Because you could get caught up in it, you know. And also as a Latina and, you know, and being queer, like, that there's times where I have to make space to understand where a man of color's homophobia is coming from. And it's like, I totally get it, you know. I've had to deal and understand that my whole life. And I feel that I'm not able to do that. I mean, I understand a lot of things about what men have to go through and men of color in my culture, like, and I have compassion for it. But to combine it with homophobia, it's to not make an excuse, but to help. I'm not down for it right now, so.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I'm curious about, I was also thinking about the Q-Sides project because thinking about some of the other work that you've done that's very, and maybe this is too much of an artificial divide, but some of it has been much more archival and finding this found footage. And then in that case, you were referencing old historic images, but restaging them and reinterpreting them. Yeah. And so how do you move back and forth between like using the historic images and generating your own films, images? Like, when do you decide to use one or the other strategy?
Well, you know, but the Q-Sides was just been in my imagination for so long, and then to have been able to manifest that. I mean, Q-Sides, you know, when I was, like, listening to the East Side Story, I was, like, you know, 13, 14, listening to those oldies and just imagining being with the girl that I was longing for. You know, it's also, like, it's it's almost answering that longing cue sides for that, you know? And like, and that those oldies, they're like the spaceship that took me to the, for it to be happening, you know? So I feel like cue sides for me without knowing that I was going to be a piece of art, like I've been working on that when I was imagining it and like longing and seeing myself, putting myself in the images already. Do you know what I mean? So yeah. I think like I've been working on cue sides for a long time, but it's just like it manifested. Like, so it's been me in me. So even with the Tiny Loca show, like again, longing and desire, like my brother used to date some of the girls, you know, and like I get to confess my feelings to them with that show. Mm-hmm. And I was like, shoot, when you're 45, it don't matter who thinks you fine, you know? Back then, maybe I couldn't say it because you were young and all kinds of stuff. But I think there's a certain time when, like, it don't matter. Who, as long as someone thinks you're fine, it's just like... So that's kind of how I felt about it. And it is because of my, you know, they're both... Q-Sides and the Tiny Loca show, like... They were both from queer desire, you know? Mm-hmm. So, but it took like so many years to get to that place. And who gets, you know, like I feel very fortunate that I get to confront my desires or mm-hmm. not confront them, but that the my love song worked, you know? So mm-hmm. I think that's those two pieces, I think is desire and longing. And I feel fortunate that I got to manifest it, you know? In collaboration too, yeah, with the archival stuff, I feel very fortunate that I've worked with Ray Balbaran, who he shot films. He taught the community how to use a Bolex. He was teaching people skills around cameras, and he had all this, you know, like all these films that collected over time, and. Thank God for wives that are like, you need to get that out of our house. And we met up. He did a lot of work with my brother. He's been doing a lot of community work with young men in the mission, like, forever. Like, Ray Balbaran is, like, a very special mission person. And I got to go through all his footage and just categorize it, you know, like, oh, this is here, this is then, this is around this year. And I just found so many treasures in that. Been there's the lowrider images that they're in there from the film Why I Ride Low and Slow. That footage was shot on a Bolex too, for you camera nerds, 16 millimeter. And he was shooting down when the lowriders were cruising in the 80s because there was a lot of police brutality, a lot of police harassment. Mm-hmm. So that's what he was documenting. But it's also such a beautiful document of street culture in the mission. Like, I mean, it's just so gorgeous. I think it's around Christmas time, so there's the Christmas lights that used to go around, and everything just so shiny. All the homies in the corner just hanging out, the beautiful women, and I'm very fortunate that we're part of an archival group, and I'm very fortunate that I have found that treasure. And I feel like I'm fortunate that I get to work with a lot of archival stuff from the mission, you know, like it has just come to me, and like I feel like it. I'm supposed to be doing something with it, you know?
Thank you for listening to the podcast this week. You can follow Vero on Instagram at GordoFaceSF and be sure to keep your eye out for our next storytelling and film project in 2019. During the season, episodes of the podcast will be released every other Wednesday through artpractical.com. The Art Practical audio feed on iTunes, SoundCloud, or your favorite podcast app. If you enjoy the podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review. All of those will help others also find the podcast. We're on Instagram at un_making. If you have thoughts, feedback, criticisms, or just want to discuss anything you've heard today, you can also reach out to me directly at Weston, that's WESTON, at artpractical.com. Many thanks to the people who make this podcast possible. The California Arts Council supports Art Practical through their Arts and Public Media Grant Program. Marissa Dietz edits the podcast. Art Practical Audio-Video Editor-in-Chief Leila Buifue provides editorial guidance and oversight. Michelle Carlson is our executive producer, and Alexa Burrell created our intro and outro music this year. You can follow her work at Fog Apocalypse on Instagram and alexacristineburrell.com.